In the 21st century, those who change the world are those who change the culture. They get people in sync, lead tribes, create movements, and generate an energy field where ordinary people achieve extraordinary results.
I think the culture is based on common sense, on professional ethics, and on a clear purpose. So for me, these are the important things. And I don't want to make it bigger than it is, because it's about very simple principles. So it's about trying to do meaningful things for people who need it.
I'm Aga Weyer, and this is the Culture Lab podcast, where you will find ideas and inspiration on how to harness the power of team and organizational culture. I talk to leadership thinkers, culture experts, entrepreneurs, and all sorts of movers and shakers, and together we explore the fascinating topic of culture, leadership, and personal growth. If you like what you hear, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Or better yet, write a review on iTunes and share the podcast with your followers and friends on social media. For more, check out our archive at www.agabayer.com/podcast. Hi, and welcome to episode 46. My guest today is Jos de Blok. Jos is the founder and the CEO of BoardZorg. I have to say that I find BoardZorg fascinating. It's a Dutch company that has now exceeded 12,000 employees, and they're expanding as well to many other countries, including Sweden, US, Belgium, Japan, and so on and so forth. And what they do is they offer community-based services to more than 70,000 patients per year. They are unique in many different ways. First of all, they are truly purpose-driven. They have very simple processes, zero bureaucracy, almost, and no managers. All employees are working in self-organized teams. Jos, as the CEO, is a typical Dutchman. He tells it like it is and is very pragmatic. He's also incredibly humble. And I really enjoyed speaking to him and trying to deconstruct what makes BoardZorg and its culture so successful. Here we go. Jos de Blok. Jos, welcome to Culture Lab.
Thank you, Aga.
I am extremely excited to have you as a guest. And I know that I'm not alone, because a lot of our listeners said, oh my God, this is amazing. We can't wait for this episode. So your coming on Culture Lab definitely got a lot of people excited. So thank you for making the time to do this.
Oh, you're welcome. I hope I don't disappoint you.
I'm sure you won't. I'm 100% positive. I think that a lot of people who listen to Culture Lab know who you are. But for those few people who are not very familiar with who you are and what you do, would you be able to just give our listeners a very short introduction?
Yes, that's fine. I'm Jos de Blok, and I'm the founder and CEO of BuurtZorg Nederland, which means neighborhood care. We have an organization with 14,000 people. We started with four in 2007, and we have grown since then based on a concept which is completely based on self-organized teams. So we don't have a management structure. We only have 14,000 people working every day, taking care for patients in their houses and organizing everything themselves. So, and we are at the moment also working in 24 other countries, all countries who were interested in using the concept. And we are developing new services all the time based on the same principles.
So I really can't wait to dive into how it all started. But before we go there, I want to ask you the question that I ask all our guests. And so it's going back to maybe your early childhood and asking you about the early cultural influences that shaped you as a person. What do you think made Jos?
Oh, I come from a Catholic family, five children. I have three brothers and a sister. And my parents were always...
Were you in the middle or the youngest?
I was exactly in the middle.
Exactly in the middle, okay.
So we were brought up with an idea that we should take care for other people when people needed support, that the world should be based on solidarity. In my early years, I was already involved in different activities. My father worked at a factory. My mother was taking care for the family. And we had a lot of, influences from all kind of people, because everybody who was a bit different came into our house. So people with mental problems, disabled people. Everybody as you should be there for when somebody needed some support. So we also had, the first refugees in our small village.
Wow.
They came from Eritrea. And we enjoyed it because they cooked for us. And
fantastic food. Yeah.
Fantastic food. So at that moment, I think I was 14, 15 years old. So I wanted to become a priest when I was young. I've been a lot in the church, but that changed when I was 14, 15. Then I became more and more critical about the institute of the church.
Mm-hmm.
In that period, when I was 14, 15, I became more and more aware about how systems worked. I was very good in economics, and I was very interested in how financial system works. Mm-hmm. So macroeconomy was my favorite topic. I read books like Franz Kafka, Der Prozess, and Heinrich Böll and Edgar Allan Poe. So I was a lot in my mind. I think I got more and more awareness about how political systems can work out on people. I usually had problems with my teachers because I had always problems with authority, which were not really authority. So
I can relate to that, really. And it's also interesting that we grew up on similar books. I wonder if, if it played a role.
It played an important role, because I think my, what I told you about my family, about solidarity and how does it come that some people earn so much and some earn so less, and how do we deal with all kind of topics in society? And then these books, they show that anything can happen when the system decides to do this or that. So systems and structures, in my opinion, were often a problem for people because they are not sensitive and not listening and not smart. So in my opinion, it played a role, and also it formed my opinions on politics and so on.
Yeah.
So I started to study economics when I was 18, but I quit my study when I was 20, and then I was kind of depressed, I think. I did some holiday work when I was 16 in a hospital. So somebody said to me, why don't you become a nurse? So that's what I did. And I enjoyed it a lot. Since I was 21, I worked as a nurse in a hospital. And since I was 26, I worked as a community health nurse. So this was my life till 1994, when I was 34. I worked as a nurse.
Wow. This is so fascinating, and how those you know, the early influences of your parents, and you've used this word care so much, and how it seems mm-hmm. to have followed you throughout your life, but also how beautifully you have been able to combine then your interest in systems and economy with caring for others. So just quick question, because you said, I really enjoyed being a nurse. What was it about being a nurse that you particularly enjoyed at that time?
Oh, I was always very interested in people's lives. So when you are a nurse, you get a lot of stories from people. So people, the relationship you usually have as a nurse is very intimate. So people tell you a lot of things they won't tell anybody else. So. And that was one side of it. So I got a lot of information, but a lot of wisdom also from old people who lived their lives and had found all kind of solutions for problems in their lives. So I learned a lot from it. And at the same time, by doing little things, just being there, listening, and also taking care for people, you got a lot of rewardings. So a lot of people are very happy that if you are a good listener and if you are a good nurse, that you're helping them. So it's very meaningful work, and you get the reward directly when you're doing things. So and it's very diverse. So every person has another story, another life. So I learned to deal with all these different backgrounds, different cultures, people coming from different countries, different families.
That was your priesthood, I think, wasn't it? Because you said you wanted to be a priest, and I think you got to be one in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was more or less a vocation to become a nurse, and it felt very good. And also, what I enjoyed was also the world of nurses. So I came more or less from a financial world, studying economics, and it was all about money. And when you are in this world of nurses, where it's mostly women, it's about people. So it's about how can we support people in the best possible way. But there's also a lot of concern with each other. Mm-hmm. So how can we support each other? So this culture, this environment I worked in, it was very supportive, very caring, and also very intelligent. So I think that I always found that women are much better organizers than men. Mm. So they are much smarter in how to deal with things than men are not so practical.
That was exactly the word I thought of as well, practical. I think women tend to be a little bit more practical than guys.
I think so too. So I learned a lot. But in between, mostly women. So it was for me like
This is fascinating, Jos. And, you know, I think that our listeners would never forgive me if I didn't ask this question, because you've mentioned I've learned so much from our patients and the wisdom that people collected throughout their lives. So what are the lessons that stuck with you from those times, from your patients?
Oh, I think that, you know, you have to be aware that to be able to take care for people, you have to understand that everybody's lives is different. That the lessons that people learn during their lives are also different, and you can learn sometimes more from and somebody who has a lower education than a professor. So for me, this being open to knowledge and wisdom, and also see how people learn to deal with problems in their lives, learned me that should be part of a lot of professions that, and if you look at all kind of products or companies or whatever, if you don't listen to your client or if you don't listen to your customer and you don't really know what it means, what the product or the service you deliver means, then you will create a gap. So sensitivity is very important, empathy, listening, and that's also what I learned in organizations. So we need organizations who are able to listen to clients, patients, or other customers.
Yeah, and I can imagine that probably at some point you have noticed that gap in the system in the Netherlands, but I don't want to be making assumptions, so maybe I should be asking a question. So can you recall a moment when you felt like, you know, I need to do something about an issue and you decided to create BoardTalk?
Well, yes, I think it already started when I finished working as a nurse. I remember that I wrote a letter to my director in 1993-1994, and I did not agree with all the changes that were going on in Holland. And I think I explained why I thought that the changes were negative or were creating problems for patients and nurses. And the only thing the director said was, we can't do anything else. We are standing with our back against the wall. So I said, that's quite a pity that that's the only thing you can think of. So what I saw was that at that moment, I saw that I would like to do it differently. I would like to do things based on the things patients need and what not the nurses need. So I started to become a manager because they asked me to in 1994-1995. So, but then in 10 years working as a manager and director, I was director of innovations in the last part of before I started with BuurtZorg, and I learned that it became more and more difficult to close the gap between the nurses and the management. So for me, the organization grew and it grew and then merged with other organizations. And it became more and more political behavior between directors and boards and managers. And I thought, this is not what we should do, because it is creating more and more complexity, it's creating more and more problems. And we are not listening anymore to the needs of the patients. So for me, that was, I think in 2004, 2005, the reason to, together with some friends, to design something else. And we took, I think, one and a half, 2 years for designing something what we called BuurtZorg.
Yeah. And so you use this word design. So I imagine that there was a vision of what this organization could become when you were doing that. Is that true? And if yes, what was your vision back then? Was it what you have created today, yeah, or has reality exceeded your expectations?
No. I think with my background and also with all the things I've done, I had an idea that the connection between nurses and patients should be in the center of healthcare, and so by building something on trustful relationships, I had the idea that we could reduce the costs. So that was one. So I wanted to beat the system with their own weapons. Always about, it was always about the money, and I am a pacifist, so I'm not focusing on weapons. But then the second one was that I as a nurse, I think I understood the world of nurses, so I think I wanted to create an environment where every nurse would like to work in. So that was the second, and I was sure that if if the nurses were happy with what they were doing, that also the patients would feel that they were doing the best possible thing. Mm-hmm. So I had the expectation that by doing this and by also supporting it with a very smart IT solution, that we could easily grow and scale, and that we would grow that throughout the years to thousands of nurses. So that was that was one of my expectations when we began in 2006.
Yeah. So someone told you in 2006 that after 10 years or 11 years, you would grow to 14,000 people. Would you believe that?
Yes.
I love that.
Yes, so, I thought, I always said it's not necessary, because we said we didn't have any growth targets or something. We always said we are going to create something where everybody wants to work in. Mm-hmm. So we said it should be the best environment. So, but if it would have been less, it was also fine. Yeah. So it's not about the number.
I understand that.
The only thing we wanted to, and that was the amount was quite important, because we wanted to create a transition in healthcare. So we wanted to show that a lot of things could be done differently by organizing differently. And creating an environment which leads to much better outcome. So we wanted to change the healthcare system. So that was our ambition. Yeah. We even didn't mind to build a new company. That was not our main purpose.
But you wanted to transform the system. And I think you had a clear vision of what this new system would look like, which seems to be one of the really important factors, and that gave you the confidence to really go for it, I suppose. And I think that this is so inspiring also to know that someone's starting with a team of four people, but they are confident that it can grow to the size that it is today. And I'm curious, because what you have spoken to me about is, now everyone talks, of course, about the importance of having a clear purpose and vision, and you had that. And also you focused on what we consider now the right things, because basically you said, I wanted to create an environment that nurses would love to work in, which is the employee experience, a very popular term nowadays. And also you wanted to focus on providing the right kind of service for your clients, which in that case were the patients. Which now everyone calls customer experience. And so I'm curious, were you that aware of what you were doing and why you were doing it back then, or was it an intuitive process?
No, I think we were very aware about what we were doing. And it was based on I think, my experiences in the last 40 years. So already in my secondary school, I think we should do things with a purpose. So I was I was very aware that the way we treat people, or the way we are dealing with things in the world, would create a lot of problems if we go on like this. Mm-hmm. So I was inspired by the Club of Rome in 1967. Where already was said that this growth, economical growth, and also the way we deal with it would create a lot of problems like pollution, climate change, and so on. So for me, the way I saw that organizations were developing in the 70s and 80s and 90s was less and less based on purpose. So I saw that was a big problem, that we talked about missions and visions and strategies and so on. And at the same time, a lot of organizations lost the connection with society.
Yeah.
So the profit and creating profit became a purpose at its own. So I think always a bit different than a lot of my colleagues, because I said, if we don't feel anymore that we are there for patients, and we are focusing on growth or whatever, then we are doing the wrong things. And nurses feel that. Nurses can feel that if they can't work according to their professional ethics, they will have more and more, you will have more and more disengagement. Yeah. So you will see that people will lose their faith in the organization they're working in, and they're just doing it for the patients. They will only work for the patients, and they will say, okay, the organization is a big burden, but it's the only way I can earn my money. So I have to have an employer. So the idea that when we started, it was based, I think, on philosophical ideas. It was based on sociological ideas that if you create an environment which fits the ethics of healthcare workers, that it would create more ownership and more engagement. And then, of course, the satisfaction of patients. When what I experienced myself as a nurse is if you are able to take time, if you are able to listen, and if you are able to be there and schedule the activities when they are needed, to do it all yourself, then it will lead to high satisfaction rates.
Absolutely. So I'm sure that giving people that sense of purpose and connection to why they are working and creating that environment is probably one of the key success factors. But I'm curious, when you look back at this journey of now almost 12 years, what were other key elements that you believe enabled you to grow so fast and to be so incredibly successful? Because you are serving, I think, over 70,000 patients per year, right? And you have the highest employee satisfaction. It's completely through the roof in your segment, and also patient satisfaction. So what are those elements that you believe made you so successful and enabled you to grow so fast?
Yes, I think I can mention several, but I think what's very important was that we all those years we stayed very close to what we wanted, and that was the best possible outcome, the best possible results for patients. So all the time, from the start, I was talking with other nurses about what is good nursing, what do we perceive as a good practice. So I visited many, many houses, I think hundreds of places where nurses organized an evening, and we were talking all evening about what do we want to achieve, what do we want to create. And most nurses I talked with said, yes, this is what we want. So, and usually after an evening talking about this, they said, when can we start? And then usually after a few weeks, they started our own team. And this team grew. And what we did by doing this was, I think, creating a lot of role models. So a lot of nurses also started to talk about it this way. So it created a network of nurses all over the country who were inspiring other nurses. Yeah. So this network created, I think, a culture of ownership, where everybody felt, okay, in our neighborhood, we are going to do it like this. We know the people in our neighborhood, and we are going to build our own small company in our neighborhood. So that was one, I think, a very strong based on a very strong culture, a very strong development, where everybody was becoming more and more an advocate for what we were doing. And of course, it went hand in hand with the satisfaction of patients. So patients were also talking about it a lot with other people, families, and so on. So the mouth-to-mouth publicity was enormous. And because of that, we got a lot of publicity from a lot of new news magazines, newspapers, television programs, and so on. So, and another important thing we did was, I think we built at the right moment, we built the right software. So we started, one of my friends, Art Levering, was one of my colleagues in the organization I worked before, and he was an IT strategist and also a musician. And I always said he composed the most beautiful IT strategy.
Yeah, so, I love that.
He has this feeling for, he's very sensitive for an IT person. So he understands the world of nurses. And he said, we have to build something what nurses enjoy to do. Mm. So a lot of nurses hate administration. Yeah. So he said, we are going to take away the administration. We're going to ask them what we can do to make their work enjoyable. So we created this IT system where people could share their experiences and could easily do their registration, don't spend too much time. All the mindless things were in the IT system and the mindful things were in their daily work. So all these practical things that you need to do in your daily work were solved by this wonderful IT system, which also made it possible to scale up so fast.
Yeah.
So we said, okay, it doesn't matter if you have 10 or 100 or 200 teams. It can all be supported by the same IT system. Mm-hmm. So that was a very important thing. And then I think the third one was that we created a very supportive back office. So we said we are only going to do what the teams or the nurses want us to do. So we're not going to create an HR department, not a quality department or a financial department. We said, okay, we have several services. So, and we are going to develop them in a way that we are avoiding all kind of unnecessary things. Mm-hmm. So we keep it small back office. We try to integrate as much as possible. And we try to do it as smart as possible. So few people in the back office supporting all the teams with practical advices when they were needed.
That's all really, really fascinating. So as you say, what was important was this sense of purpose, enabling technology, enabling basically your people to focus on what they do best is what I'm hearing and what they love doing, and finding ways to unburden them from the stuff that sort of drags them down and consumes unnecessarily a lot of time.
Yeah.
And then finding other smart ways, as you say, to support them in doing what they are best at. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that you know, when as you were scaling, you talked about those loosely connected groups of people that were unified by this common purpose and how it had an impact and sort of started spreading, which I think is a very fascinating idea as well. And now a lot of people talk about how to create movements, and it seems to be the same dynamic there, where you create something that is worth discussing and sharing with others because it is so great. And then patients talk about it and employees talk about it and the media want to start covering this topic. Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that strong culture that permeates what who you are and what you do, and how you started scaling it through those role models. So how would you describe your culture in a few words?
In a few words? I think that what we, as I think as nurses, have is a very logic, common sense. So I think the culture is based on common sense, on professional ethics, and on a clear purpose. So for me, these are the important things. And I don't want to make it bigger than it is, because it's about very simple principles So it's about
trying
to do meaningful things for people who need it. So people in vulnerable positions who sometimes are at the end of their lives, have severe dementia. Just heard from the doctor that I had cancer. These are the people we're dealing with, and the nurses have this vocation. They want to do the best possible things, and they want to do it in a very practical way. And they want to have the autonomy to decide themselves on what's needed to take care for my patients. So that's and it's all mostly is based on common sense, on reflecting on what you're doing. Also the support, I think it's a very supportive system. So the teams are very closely working together. They're very supportive to each other. They hire their own colleagues, so they find other nurses who have the same attitude, the same vision, same idea.
That would be my question, because I would be curious, you know, how do you make sure that you make this culture consistent across so many teams? Because you have over, you know, so many people, 14,000 people. I think they work in teams of 12.
10, 12.
Yeah. Maximum. So how do you scale that? I mean, what are the practical things that the teams are doing to ensure, and you are doing as an organization, to make sure that this culture is consistent, so they're consistently pragmatic and focused on what really matters? Could you talk to us a little bit about, you know, how that works? You've mentioned already that the nurses themselves hire other nurses that would fit the culture and believe the same things. What other things do you pay attention to?
Well, I think it's also about what you don't do. So we try to avoid all kind of management language. So we talk about patients and what patients need and what we can do about it to support them. So the focus is a lot on the vision. So how do we perceive healthcare problems, and how can we support people in dealing with these healthcare problems in a way that they stay as independent as possible? So the vision is a very important thing, that we say, okay, the topics we talk about are always related to patient problems or to healthcare problems for patients. So the language is the language of nurses. I think that's important, because what I learned in the organizations I worked before, it was a lot about strategy, policies, policy notes, and more and more management language was used to explain things. And we said, okay, let's don't do that. We don't make policy plans. We just talk about the practical things we meet in daily practice. And that's what we do continuously. So I started to write blogs, for example. We have this Butoch web, what we call. It's like a Facebook, working like a Facebook. And everybody can write ideas, concerns, questions, experiences. So that's also what I do. And then a lot of nurses are reading the blogs and are responding on it. So it leads to a continuous discussion, dialogue with everybody about the important topics.
As I've been listening to you, really a conclusion that came to my mind is that clearly purpose and vision are not enough. And I think that was very clear from what you'd experienced as part of the old system, being a nurse yourself, because you still had that purpose that you wanted to care about patients, but you were not able. And it's almost like I'm hearing from you is, you know, give people or gather people around the purpose, around something that is meaningful for them, and then just remove all the obstacles, rather than just trying to build up a system around this that very often, unfortunately, becomes a bureaucratic monster.
Yes.
So you remove the obstacles and give some simple tools that enable them to do what they love really well.
No, I think that in a lot of organizations, the assumption is that we need all these things. So that we need all these tools, the HR tools, quality tools, and so on. And we say, no, a lot of these things are developed in time and they became a purpose on their own. And when you have these people, these policy people who are involved in these things, they're creating their own worlds. So, and when you have these worlds, it's very difficult to get rid of that. No, so if you start something new, so as we did, we were convinced that by not creating these roles and all these functions, that it would be much better.
And I think this leads us in nicely to some of the questions that we've received from our listeners. Because I do have questions about some of these systems, conventional systems, management systems, and also how all of these things would be applicable to more conventional organizations. But before we move there, I just have one last question, which is about how do you perceive your role as the leader of this organization? What is the most important thing for you?
Most important thing, I think it's always difficult to answer these kind of questions, because it's changing in time. Mm-hmm. At the moment, I say we are in a kind of next stage, because we build a lot of trust in the system, outside Butzer. So we are now making contracts with the health insurers together, which was impossible a few years ago. So I think the most important part of my role is to work as a kind of a heat shield for the outside world. So try to avoid that all kind of regulations and all kind of changes in the system are influencing our way of working. So focusing on continuity within the organization and keeping us close to the principles, but, and keep on having the same discussions, the same dialogues. So being aware that being close to what we're to the nurses, close to the patients, and not focusing too much on the policy world or the system world.
I love that.
Just stay as normal as possible.
Yeah. And that I imagine that can be a challenge sometimes, because the external world is pushing very often to become and sort of shape you into something that's perhaps you wouldn't like to become. Yeah. So I imagine that there's a lot of discipline around saying no to things and being really true to what you want to be.
Yeah.
That's wonderful. So let's shift and move to questions from our listeners, because some of them are in this area, as I've mentioned, of traditional processes.
Time for your questions.
Hi, Aga. This is Alison McTavish from Switzerland.
Hi, this is Dale Hintz. I'm submitting a question to the Culture Lab.
Hi, Aga. I just want to say thank you so much for doing the podcast.
I have a question for Culture Lab.
Hello, my name is Morten Abbey from Denmark.
Hi, Ed. This is Tim Kuppler.
Hi, I'm Kostas. I have a question for you, Michael.
I'd love to hear your answer. Thank you.
Thanks for entertaining my question.
Now you've got rid of the managers, how do you measure performance across the organization from the teams upwards? That would interest me a lot.
One of the topics when I started is that in the system we had, I think the performance about the right things was not measured. So we measured a lot of things, and we had a lot of indicators, but not, in my opinion, not the right ones. Because I said we don't know what the results are of what nurses are doing. So we are measuring the hours, minutes, products, and whatever kind of things we are. But it doesn't give any information about if you're doing the right things. So we started to introduce what we call the Omaha system. It comes from Omaha in the US, and it's developed in Minnesota. And what we said is we're going to measure the interventions and the results of the interventions. So we integrated it in our IT system. And in 2015, it became the national standard for Holland. So we said we can show to the inspection, to the health insurers, we can give them much more information about the performance of the nurses than what we had before. And another thing is that we connected it to the financial part. So we said we can easily show, and that was one of the smart things in our IT system too. We can easily show what the average costs are per client, per month, per year. So we can say, okay, we have this outcome on the quality side and this outcome on the quantity side. And every team can see it from their team, and we can also make it regional. We can make it national. We can compare it with other organizations. So there are many ways we can show the performance without having management.
So who inputs the data on performance? Yeah. Do the team members do it themselves?
Yes, it's part of the daily work. So they make the they make the care plans. They decide on the problems they have to deal with. They measure the results of their intervention. So it's all integrated in the daily work of the nurses. So you don't need anybody to create.
To tell you.
But also not to transform this this information into data. So what we get out of is thousands of files. So we have hundred thousands of files we are using for research. So, and we're sharing trend reports with the health insurers. So we don't have people who are coordinating this. If you look at Buurtzorg itself, if you say we have some guidelines, we said on quality, on the collaboration in the teams, and on the financial part, we have some guidelines. So every team can follow their own results. So it's all in the integrated system. So it's not, we don't make reports, it's just there all the time, real time. So it's a different way that if you have a traditional organization, you have people who are measuring things and creating all kind of tools. And so we said, no, we have an integrated system where everything is dealt with.
And I think that the amazing benefit of that is also that people get feedback on their own performance real time, in a way, because the moment you input data, you can have a look at how you've been doing. And research has shown us that actually this is one of a hugely motivating factors for people at work, if they can get feedback from the job itself rather than someone telling them, oh, you are doing really well.
Yes, I agree completely.
Yeah, so this is awesome. Just give us a little bit of a taste of how simple this system is for people to use. How much time would you say a nurse spends on inputting data and giving you the information that you need to run your analysis afterwards and get the information that you need?
Yeah, almost nothing. You know, it's part of the daily work. When you are visiting a patient, you have to discuss with the patient what you're going to do. So, and then you are just in your care plan, you can just put on some spots or push on a button and you say, this is what I've done and this is the result. So it's just minutes. And you have to do it, because my idea about good healthcare is that you have a good dialogue with the patient and you decide together on what you're doing.
So it's not
doing something extra, but by doing it in this way with this software, all the registration, the things you register, can be used for different purposes. So it's also at the same moment, it's also the source for the salaries. It's also the source for the billing. So everything they're doing can be used for many purposes.
Yeah.
So and the time they spend per day, it's just about minutes. So they
That's
can.
That's incredible.
Yeah. So it's not we said that we try to avoid unnecessary bureaucratic activities.
So Imran, I hope you got your answer. And let's move to Sean's question. And Sean and Imran are founders of Kokoro, which is a consultancy that focuses on culture. And Sean has the following question.
Yos, thanks. My name is Sean. I'm representing Kokoro. And I'm curious, what was the mantra that you continue to repeat in your organization as you begin to scale, to continue to reinforce particular behaviors and patterns that you wanted to accentuate or continue to see flourish? I'm really curious about what the thing was that you saw as being the key element of holding that together during the scaling process. Thank you.
That's Om.
I know that you have already shared with us that you've spoken a lot about what the patients want, and it's all about serving patients. So I wonder if it was that or something else.
No, I was several times in India, so I had my own mantra, Om Namah Shivaya. But that's something else.
Good.
Now, what we just said from the start is we wanted to deliver the best possible care. So that was, I think, for most nurses, an important mantra. So we said, we focus on the patient, and we try to create the best possible conditions for these patients. So I think that was simple. It's also on the logos on the cars, for example, the best care at home. So. That was one of the mantras, and the other one was better care for lower cost. So we said we can increase the quality, we can improve it, and at the same time the costs will decrease, because by doing the right things you avoid unnecessary things. So these two, I think, were important mantras. One was more for the inside, and the other one was more for the outside, for example, for the health insurance.
So two more questions, and they both come from Chandir. He lives in Zurich. And the first one is, if you were requested, or challenged to reproduce the success story in a large-size profit-making organization, for example, in banking like ING Bank or chemicals like Shell, how would you go about doing it?
Oh, I think, in a matter of fact, I've been asked to consult the banks in Holland, most of them. And I'm even involved in the Sberbank in Russia. A lot of banks are struggling with their purpose and the connection with society. So I think with one of the banks, I discussed what is your real purpose? And a lot of people who are working in this bank, they feel that they, in the past, they have been losing their relationships with their customers. So what I would do is, what I think a lot of companies should do, is to create awareness about what will be your purpose for the coming 10 to 20 years, and what kind of connections do you need with your customers to be still relevant, and then what does it mean for the way you're doing things? So, and then I said, start listening to the people who have the relationships with the customers, because they know best what they hear day in, day out about what customers would like or would appreciate. So, and by creating this awareness, I think, and at the same time, to get inspired by new ways of organizing, I think that could be a starting point. And then if the top of the organization, the top level, C-level, is convinced that they should change their policies of their way of working, then it's a starting point of a transformation. And this transformation can be done in different ways, but there's not enough time now for explaining this. But if you want to know more, we have a consulting part too. So we give a lot of advice on a lot of companies who are struggling with this journey.
Fantastic. So we are going to post some links in the show notes so that our listeners who are interested in that can have a look and reach out to you. So this is really fascinating. And I'd like definitely to learn more myself as well. So I might be knocking on your door. And the second question from Chandir is about the major roadblocks, especially from culture perspective, but also overall business result as well, that you faced during the 12-year journey. So I asked you about key sort of factors to success, and he's asking the opposite side of the coin. What were the roadblocks? What did you have to overcome?
Oh, that was, I think, the biggest roadblock, if you can say so, was the fast growth and response of the system players. So what we saw was that we had quite an impact, because there were hundreds and thousands of nurses stepping over from another organization or hospitals to Buurtzorg. We are paid by health insurers in Holland, and they couldn't believe that this fast growth, which never happened before, was real. So they were very skeptical about where does all these patients come from, and are you picking people from the street and treating them as patients? These kind of things. So they sometimes refused to pay for them. So then, I remember 2010, we had some struggles with that, and they were not paying for 4 or 5 million euro at that moment. So we said, as long as we have more income as costs, we don't think it's a big problem. So we also were growing and doing things we were not paid for. And I think these discussions with the health insurance were, I think, for us the biggest roadblock. So
I understand that it had to do with building trust with the outside system, as you say, because they were so completely out of sync in a way. What you were doing was so different and so fast and so efficient that they just couldn't believe that it could be legit and really happening. Yeah. Wow. Okay. I'm mindful of your time. I know that we've only scheduled for 1 hour. Do you still have a couple of minutes for the rapid fire questions?
Yes, fine. Shoot.
So the idea is that I'm going to ask you 5 questions in a rapid succession, and you'll aim to answer them in 2 minutes.
Okay.
And the first question is about your definition of organizational culture. How do you define it?
Organizational culture. Yes, I think it's behavior. How do we openly and honestly behave with each other? So behavior, for me, is the biggest, most important thing of culture.
Mm. And what would you say are the signs that a company culture needs some work, or perhaps even a major overhaul?
I think when people are disengaged, when there are complaints about the service or the products, when you feel there is no connection anymore between the different levels in an organization. So these are, I think, symptoms of disintegration. And if you say culture should lead to more engagement and integration in the organization and more passion and inspiration, All these things, I think, symptoms of lack of cultural alignment.
And are there any companies that you admire for their culture? And if yes, what are the reasons?
No.
I love your honesty.
I admire people, but I don't admire organizations.
Right. And are there any books on culture, on leadership, on management that you would recommend to our listeners?
Oh, yes. I think a lot of the listeners perhaps already read Frederic Laloux, Reinventing Organizations.
I love this book.
That's one. I think I'm working very closely together with Shada Nandram. She wrote Organizational Innovation by Integrating Simplification. And it's based on her study of 3 years working for Buurtzorg. She's also writing new books about integrating intelligence and of integrative intelligence. And I think Peter Drucker is always interesting. But I don't read so much myself. There are also other fields. There are some philosophers I really like. One is a Dutch philosopher called Arnold Cornelis. And he wrote a book about the logic of feeling and the way you can slow down your own time.
Fantastic. We're going to post the links to the books if anyone wants to check it out, and you will find them in the show notes. Yeah. So finally, in our Culture Lab, the reason that we called it this way is that I believe that life is a series of experiments that we need to run with an open mind. And so I'm wondering, would you recommend our listeners run some experiments so that they can cultivate the right culture in their organization, the kind of culture that will help them to bring their vision to life?
Yeah, I think what you just said about the open mind, I think that's one of the most important things. What I learned is focusing on ethics, listening to people, creating dialogues. Instead of my experience that management is a lot of, sending a message. But I think we have to become listeners instead of sending messages. So listening, creating dialogues, and also thinking about what's the real purpose of the people who are working in daily life. And I think what was very important for us was simplifying. So reducing complexity. Complexity is creating dependency. And if you reduce complexity, then people will be empowered. People will feel more ownership and they will feel more responsibility and want to contribute to the environment I work in. So these are some.
I love that. And this is actually one of our corporate values as well at my company, simplicity. It's so hard to really be simple, but not to oversimplify things and not to dumb things down as well. I love that. So one last question from me, which is, do you have a guest to recommend that you believe would be a great guest for this podcast?
I thought about it, but I couldn't think of somebody. I'm working very closely together with somebody in the UK. Who's called Brendan Martin. And Brendan Martin has a history in public service. And he studied politics. How do you call it? Politics? But he's now working closely with us to introduce Buurtzorg in the UK. So, and he has his own view on society and on culture and so Brendan Martin.
Yeah, I'd love to speak to him.
Okay.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. Thank you very much. So finally, do you have any closing remarks, something that you would like to leave our listeners with?
No, I hope the listeners are not disappointed, as I said.
I'm sure they won't be. On the contrary.
I think that perhaps the last word I would say is that consistency, being consistent in what you say and what you do, and trying to align the different perspectives in the organizations in a consistent way, that really helps. And it also makes a lot of things much easier and less complicated. So I hope that people enjoy listening, and people also enjoy the daily work, because joy and pleasure makes lives much easier.
So true. Jos, thank you so much for your time. This was an incredibly informative and inspiring conversation for me.
Thank you.
I've learned a lot from you, and I'm sure that our listeners have learned a lot. If they want to find out more about your organization, your consulting practice, what is the best place to go to?
Oh, they can find Buurtzorg International on the internet. And I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
Just Google it. Yeah. But we're going to post some links as well for our listeners. Okay. Well, thank you so much again, and have a wonderful day.
I'm Aga Bayer, the creator and host of the Culture Lab podcast. And this is the Culture Lab team.
Production manager, Lindsay Nunez.
Art director, Emily Spencer.
Aaron Scott, content editor.
Sound producer, James Eid, Be Heard.
And now, a quick preview of our next episode. First, I just want to say why I wanted Jim on the podcast. One of the most consistent themes that emerged out of now more than 50 interviews with outstanding culture thinkers is fear. Fear often prevents us from standing out and leading change, and also doesn't allow us to be open to change as much as we'd like to. Plus, toxic cultures breed really well in fear. And so I thought that we need someone who can shed a bit of light on how to work with our fears and how to overcome them. And this is where Jim Lawless comes in. He's the author of the best-selling Taming Tigers book. And in Taming Tigers, he talks about how everybody has a tiger in their lives. It's probably the same thing that Stephen Pressfield calls resistance. It's the force that paralyzes us every time we think about making a change in our lives and doing something bold or important. And I think that each aspiring culture revolutionary needs to learn how to tame their tigers. So here we go. Here's a short preview of our conversation.
As humans, of course, we know we can do great things. We can operate on amazing purpose and create legacy and contribution and create great objectives and then go and achieve them. We can do all of that, but we're going to be constantly struggling with what I call now the fear algorithm, which is scanning the horizon just underneath the surface of our consciousness and is very fast acting, scanning the horizon for risk and uncertainty. And its job, its evolutionarily brilliant bonus that it brings us, and it is a bonus, is to protect us very quickly from risk and uncertainty, way faster than before our conscious brain can get involved, our goal-setting contribution brain can get involved. So we live in this tension between, I want to move forward, do great things, create contribution, legacy, and hit objectives, and a big parachute pulling behind us that is called risk and uncertainty and the fear algorithm. The fear algorithm fires off into the limbic system at incredible speed. So we're getting a physiological change, a chemical change, different regions of the brain taking over our cognition. All of that's happening involuntarily unless we're trained in how to deal with it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Culture Lab. If you found any moments that were interesting, inspiring, or maybe even game-changing, please share it with someone who'd appreciate it. After all, good ideas are meant to be shared.